The 1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 132, The Future of Mormon Theology, a panel led by Dennis Potter and panelists Eugene England, Clark Goble, Benjamin Huff, and Susan Perry.
Does anyone know if I have to do anything to start the recording, or is it voice-operated? It's voice-operated? Okay, so maybe the recording is going. Okay. Well, actually, why don't I have someone find that out for sure? We want to make sure that this session gets recorded. I'm sorry, we found out it is automatic. So, welcome to the session on the future of Mormon theology. We have a panel here. My name is Dennis Potter. I'm a PhD candidate in philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. I'll be the moderator and a panelist. Oh, okay. Let me make sure I talk into the microphone. To my right is Ben Huff, a PhD student in philosophy, also at the University of Notre Dame. To his right, Eugene England, vernacular Mormon theologian extraordinaire. Susan Perry, a PhD student in philosophy at the University of Minnesota, and Clark Goble is a manager at Information Technologies in Provo, Utah, has degrees in mathematics and physics with a minor in philosophy as well. So you see the philosophy connection here. What we're going to do is each of us is going to give a 10 to 15 minute presentation. What we're going to do is each of us is going to give a 10 to 15 minute presentation, and then we will open it up to questions after that. I think that's the best way to proceed. And if we want to respond to each other, hopefully there'll be some disagreement here. If we want to respond to each other, then we can do that in the question and answer period as well. Let me tell you a little bit about why I thought that this would be a good idea. I decided I would organize this panel for this Sunstone Symposium, because last year at Sunstone there was a series of presentations, papers that were given on theology or theological issues, more so than maybe had been given in recent years at Sunstone. Sunstone had become more and more concerned with issues non-theological, maybe social critique and so forth, historical issues. And although it started out as a theological symposium, it had kind of gotten a little bit away from its roots, and some of us were trying to bring us back to those theological roots. And it was a wonderful experience last year. Some very, very good papers were given, and there was a lot of discussion that generated out of it, a lot of discussion over dinner, over lunch, and continuing over email across America. We talked about these theological issues, and we thought that it would be good for us to also discuss the directions that maybe Mormon theologians should take in the future and the methods that they should use, to what extent have we done it right, and to what extent do we need to modify the way we do it to make things better in the future? So, I guess the order that we'll go in will be myself, Ben, Susan, Clark, and then Gene will finish up the panel. So I'll start out here. The title of my presentation is The Philosophies of Men and Women, Mormon Theology After Y2K. Whether we like it or not, we Mormons do theology. In gospel doctrine class, we ask what a passage means. In formulating our views on hot political topics, we appeal to aspects of our religious beliefs. When opponents of Mormonism offer evidence against the Book of Mormon or some other aspect of our beliefs, we try to explain how this evidence can fit our view. Sometimes we even wonder what the justification is for beliefs which are part of our religious culture but which seem problematic in some way. Interpretation, drawing out implications, defending, and reconciling. These are what theologians do with their religious beliefs. And although it is common to say Mormonism doesn't have theologians, it is more accurate to say Mormonism doesn't have anyone who is not a theologian. This puts in perspective the claim that doing theology leads to apostasy. If it does, the apostasy is inevitable. So, if theology is inevitable for a religious community such as ours, then why don't we try to do it well? I believe that there are some things which we can do which will help us to improve the state of Mormon theology. We should first, this is point one, we should pay attention to traditional Judeo-Christian theology. There are several reasons for doing this. First, in part, doing theology is an evangelical affair. Theology is apologetic and persuasive. And we are, after all, a proselyting culture. Why should we limit proselytization skills in such a way that we cannot talk intelligently with people from other faiths? In effect, this is what we have done. We've limited ourselves. We use the same terms as our Protestant and Catholic brothers and sisters, but with different meanings. This lands us in misunderstanding. Second, traditional theology makes mistakes. We have to know traditional theology to know where its mistakes are. Third, traditional theology is based on a set of scriptures that for the most part are had in common with us. They might have something to teach us about the way of appropriate distinctions, historical insights with regard to these scriptures. Why should we spend time reinventing the wheel when other people have already done the work? Two, we should build on the traditional Mormon theological works as well as on scriptures. Many past Mormon leaders and intellectuals have interesting things to say about theological issues. I'm thinking of Joseph Smith, Orson Pratt, Brigham Young, B.H. Roberts, Joseph Fielding Smith, James Talmage, Stephen Robertson, Eugene England, Blake Osler. These are just to name a few. There are obviously others. We should be reading the works of these theologians, critiquing them, and improving on them. Also, there are some theological pieces in particular which have come to have quasi-official status in the Mormon community. I'm thinking of pieces like the King Follett Discourse. Our theology should be responsive to such pieces. We have a faculty of reason. We should use it, and we should also know the work of others who have used it. Third point, we need to have professional theologians. Now, I'm not saying we need some official theologians like John Ratzinger would be for the Catholic Church. I mean, we need people who go into the academic discipline of theology. Part of why we need this was stated above already. We need to do our thinking in the world, even if we do not think with the world. But more importantly, we need to build a theological tradition of apologetic interpretation and speculation, which can be there for college students who begin to think about their religion. Now, a lot of people, there's this general perception that at Brigham Young University, they want to do everything they can to keep people from thinking about their religion. But even if that's the case, I don't think that that's necessarily the case, but even if it is the case, that's not going to work. People will think about their religion. And as the church becomes a world religion, BYU is just, it's not going to be the place to go as a Mormon. Because the religion is going to just become too big for it. So we need to build a tradition of theology, a tradition of sources that these students can go to, that where they can find, or they can start to think about these issues, and they can find the kinds of distinctions that need to be drawn, and they can have something to build on. It's also important that these theologians, these professional theologians who can give us this kind of tradition, it's important that they be, in a very significant sense, independent. The reason that we need them to be independent of the church, not employed by the church, because they need to be believing as well, believing Mormons. Now, the reason that these two aspects are important is because they need to be independent so that their theology, their systematizations, their apology is honest. They need to be believing because it needs to be sympathetic. Fourth point, Mormon theologians need to be responsive to revelation and not expect it to conform to their social agenda. It is one thing to question the accuracy of a perceived social doctrine, and quite another thing to expect that a religious movement change to meet the standards set by the political agendas outside the movement. Mormons don't need to be embarrassed by their doctrines. They just need to understand them. If we Mormon intellectuals learn to do this, especially those who are liberal, quote-unquote, and whatever that means, then the trust between leadership and the independent intellectual can be regained. If Mormon theologians are honest in their endeavor to interpret, draw implications, defend, and reconcile Mormon revelation, then the leaders in the Mormon community will have nothing to fear. Being at Notre Dame, I think in these terms, Catholics look up to their intellectuals. Mormons are suspicious of them. We should be more like Catholics in this regard. Moreover, the way we know religious truth to some extent is by personal revelation, and there is no reason to think that personal revelation cannot play an important role even when we are doing theology in an academic way. Mathematicians usually have a flash of insight which leads them to construct the proofs that they do. I find that personal revelation functions in this way in my thoughts about religion. There are some themes in Mormon theology, this is the fifth point, there are some themes in Mormon theology which stand in need of development. First, Mormons have a unique soteriology, that is, the theory of salvation. We should develop it and articulate it. Stephen Robinson, Gene England, and Blake Osler have already done some work in this regard. But in particular, Mormons place a strong emphasis on ordinances and have a unique understanding of them, which includes the possibility of vicarious ordinances. This doctrine could use some articulation and defense. Second, Mormons have very unique beliefs about the nature of God. God is unbodied, has a personality literally like ours, etc. Now, David Paulson has done some work in this area, but for the most part, Mormons have not developed this radical nature of their theology in a systematic way. We need to develop this. Third, Mormons have a unique understanding of revelation, which allows for continuing revelation. We need to understand what this means. Fourth, the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants are full of mostly unmined theological content. Of course, there are those superficial analyses which have the Book of Mormon as an amalgamation of 19th century theological doctrines. We're all familiar with those here. But these analyses are poor at best. We need people who will take it seriously, just as seriously as the conservative biblical scholars take the Bible. But we need these people to be willing to think about the scriptures in an abstract and profound way instead of just telling us how we can apply them in our own lives today and instead of using them as a proof text for what we already believe or think that we know. Sixth point. BYU Studies, Dialogue, Sunstone, Journal of Book of Mormon Studies, Farms Review of Books, Signature Books, they're all thought to have agendas, whether this is true or not. And it might be the case that in the future there will be a truly independent peer-reviewed journal and press to which Mormon theologians can submit work. But for now, we should be publishing in mainstream journals. Get our work out there in the world instead of keeping it to ourselves. I am thinking of journals like Faith and Philosophy and the Harvard Theological Review. We want the rest of the world to understand us, but we can't help them to do so unless we give them access to our best understanding of ourselves. In my mind, doing theology, thinking about our religious beliefs, is a fundamental form of worship. I believe that as a community, we are slacking if we fail to provide future generations with a fully developed theological tradition. The time is past where our attitude should be one of avoiding the philosophies of men. The time has come where we should be using our faculty of reason, which comes from God and not man, to understand the most profound and important truths. Theology is inevitable. Let us make it so that poor theology is not.
The idea Dennis mentioned that theology leads to apostasy is not baseless. And I think it's for good reason that LDS theologians will need to work to gain the respect and trust of their church membership. By Joseph Smith's day, a world full of Christians, all reading the Bible, had very different accounts of the gospel message, all in some degree of error. The difference between them was not their scriptures, it was their theology. Since the history of this church is relatively short, and we've done relatively little theology, the very possession of developed theology, I think, can be mistaken for a sort of defining feature of the apostasy. I don't think that needs to be the case. I think it is possible to retell the gospel message truly. and that whenever we say in our own words what we understand the scriptures to mean, we are doing theology, whether we're doing it carefully or not. I doubt that the main way in which plain and precious truths were removed from the Bible was actual doctoring of the text, or even exclusion of texts. I think the problem is primarily that people continue to read the correct scriptures but cease to understand them. In the Book of Mormon, we read an account of a nation that lost the plain and precious truths of the gospel, namely King Noah's people. The priest possessed correct scripture, but Abinadi tells us that either they weren't reading it or they did not understand it. All the prophets in their scripture testified that Christ is the key to our salvation, that the law of Moses cannot be fulfilled without him. But Noah's priests did not understand this. They had lost the central message of their scripture, not by altering the text, but simply by misunderstanding it. We Latter-day Saints have several precious books of scripture besides the Bible, but this is no guarantee that we understand their message. We have been told many times that we as a church are under condemnation for failing to give the Book of Mormon, for example, enough prayerful study. On many gospel topics, there are scores of passages scattered through our scriptures, each contributing distinctive bits of insight. Being able to list such passages, as in the topical guide, is not the same as understanding what it is they are all talking about. One task of theology is to carefully compare multiple passages and integrate their teachings into a single account. Of course, such extra-scriptural accounts may have flaws that the scriptures do not, but if we don't do theology at all, our knowledge will remain fragmentary. Let's not be like the servant who wrapped his Lord's money in a napkin and buried it. We need to take some initiative and work with what we've been given. The prophet Alma shared an opinion on the resurrection that we know from modern revelation all his writings are wonderful. I think it was right for him to share that opinion, and I think we should follow his example. The key is to remember theology is only an aid to scripture study. As a community of saints, we need to study the scriptures individually and together. We are all at different stages of development in the various aspects of spiritual growth. The church is a sort of one-room schoolhouse, and while we help each other, we are not all learning the same things at the same time. To preserve this pedagogical situation, it is important that people who are obviously not authorities on scriptural interpretation do theology, so that the decision to study a given aspect of the gospel to that extent will remain firmly between individual members and the Lord, and they will rely on the Spirit to discern the truth. Contemporary LDS theology should aim for the status the Lord gives to the Apocrypha in DNC 91. Quote, "There are many things contained therein that are true, as well as some that are not, and whoso is enlightened by the Spirit shall obtain benefit therefrom." Theology should be something we do to digest the scriptures. The scriptures are difficult to read, and we have to try restating their message in our own terms to assimilate it. Once someone with some insight into the scriptures writes a piece of theology, there is a danger that others who have studied less will read theology instead of the scriptures. I think this happens a lot today in our community. For my part, I had to read the scriptures for a long time before I could get anything out of them besides old Sunday school lessons replaying in my head. There's a lot more in the scriptures than we'll learn from any piece of theology, certainly more than I had learned from my Sunday school lessons. Theology is most dangerous when there is just a little of it, like lots of other kinds of knowledge, because it is easy to suppose that it has captured the scriptural message, since the scriptures are hard to read. For example, James Talmage and Bruce R. McConkie seem for a time to have cornered the market on accounts of the atonement. As excellent as their work may be, there are many scriptures whose message has not made its way into their accounts. Hugh Nibley, for example, draws attention to other important aspects, although I also think his account is not complete. When there's enough theology for a plurality of understandings of a number of gospel principles, then it should be easier for people to see that theology is only a step on the way to understanding and to keep searching the scriptures themselves.
Let me begin by saying that I in no way consider myself to be or be a professional theologian. But I am in a discipline that requires employing sharp analytic tools to one's intuitions and beliefs. If I aspire to be a good philosopher and a faithful Latter-day Saint, then I must pursue religion with the same rigor that I pursue my studies in bioethics and philosophy of science. And this means doing theology in some sense. My first point is that the pursuit of Mormon theology is worthwhile, but unless Mormon culture becomes more accepting of its intellectuals, fewer and fewer will have the endurance sometimes necessary to pursue it at the level necessary for significant advancement. Too often, intellectualism is seen as a sure sign that a person lacks faith or is at least on a slippery slope that leads to losing faith. As long as this attitude prevails, some will find it too difficult to remain both analytical and believing. Feeling marginalized in two different communities, marginalized in one's intellectual community for taking religious beliefs seriously, and marginalized in one's religious community for taking the rigorous pursuit of theology seriously, is an arduous position to be in. Unless Mormonism becomes more accepting of its intellectuals, the future of Mormon theology looks dim. Second, it seems hasty to settle on one particular method for pursuing theology. Instead, we should be open to as many different methods as possible. If we think of theology as the critical examination and articulation of religious beliefs, then it seems reasonable that a wide range of methods exist for doing this besides the traditional methods employed by professional theologians. If all members are encouraged to be lay theologians, and I would encourage that, then certainly a variety of methods will be used. However, this should not diminish the need for members trained in particular disciplines, as Dennis has mentioned, who are also willing to devote some attention to critically examining and advancing Mormon theology. Third, the four standard works must play an integral role in doing theology. Focusing on the official canon is important for a couple of reasons. First, belief in the sanctity of the standard works is central to our religion. If we desire to better understand our own theology and to also promote the understanding of our doctrines by non-members, we should be focused on articulating and defending our unique understanding of a wide range of topics. Second, looking to the scriptures as a basis for this defense provides more credibility for theologians among the general church membership. Done well, theology must not become completely removed from the realm of the average faithful Mormon. By focusing on the scriptures, works that most members are familiar with, or at least recognize that they should be familiar with, Mormon theology can be more credible. However, this in no way implies that our study of the standard works should always be watered down to the level of some gospel doctrine classes. Fourth, revelation and reason are central components to doing theology. Without revelation, theology becomes completely removed from the realm of religion and simply becomes another academic pursuit. Without reason, theology lacks the rigor necessary to maintain a strong critical examination of beliefs. But although revelation may be essential in giving individuals insights and ideas, theology and Mormon theology must ultimately focus on reason and the employment of arguments that are accessible even to the non-believer. Mormon theology must foremost be for Mormons, but defending our beliefs to non-members is also a necessary component. This can be done only by developing arguments similar to those found in mainstream epistemology and philosophy of religion. Without this, we won't be taken seriously. I'll conclude by suggesting one particular area of theological themes in Mormonism that I think stand to be developed, and this is how our theological beliefs affect our understanding of important moral issues. I have in mind both theoretical issues and specific applied issues. Can we justify our moral beliefs without simply appealing to religious authorities, such as scriptures and church leaders? We may be able to offer simple answers about what we believe, but we need much more work to support answers about why we believe what we do. Considering applied issues, there are particular theological doctrines that, if better articulated, could help us develop a thorough understanding of why church policy maintains that something like abortion is immoral. Our understanding of the nature of existence may help to articulate a Mormon understanding of the moral concept of personhood. Likewise, our belief that matter is eternal might say something about organ transplantation. It's not enough for us to simply strive to be morally upright people. We must seek an expanded understanding of why we believe and act the way that we do. One way to approach these issues would be to develop a uniquely Mormon ethical framework grounded in our unique theology, which can articulate our beliefs on a wide range of issues affecting our broader communities. This will have several beneficial consequences. First, any time we as members gain a better understanding of our beliefs, our faith strengthened. Second, it can help non-members understand what we believe and why we believe it. Searching for similarities with religions that already have a long-standing tradition of articulating and defending moral views within a theological context will help us gain a better understanding of our own religion and will also increase the ability of Mormon academics to engage in mutual discussion with their colleagues. The future of Mormon theology can be bright, but only if we begin to take the obligation to rigorously pursue theology as seriously as we take our other religious obligations. This pursuit will flourish only if our community becomes more accepting of its intellectuals.
I once heard someone make the rather remarkable assertion that Mormonism was a religion without a theology. Now, that seemed kind of shocking to me at the time, and mainly because it seems to me that every time we open up the scriptures and try to interpret a passage, we're doing theology. Before we can read our scriptures, we have to bring to that text some kind of context, some kind of strategy we use to interpret the text. That's our theology. You know, before we can get to the text, we already have to have an idea of what we believe. Even if we're never aware that we're doing this, there's always something there that arrives before our interpretation can begin. This theology is the attempt to make sense of our religious beliefs so that we can live and study our religion. Given the popularity in the Mormon community of books like Mormon Doctrine, Jesus the Christ, Articles of Faith, and who knows how many commentaries have been written in the last century, it's really surprising that anyone would say we have no theology. What then do these people mean? I can't really say for certain what they mean, but I've, unfortunately, in my past made similar comments, so maybe I'm sort of qualified to make a guess of what they mean. I think that we, as a people, have a great distrust of fixed approaches to our religion. It isn't theology or doing theology that we worry about so much. It's the idea that one approach to God will be ruled correct by fiat and replace all others. Perhaps looking at the history of mainstream Christianity, we have cause for this concern. The warnings about the philosophy of men mingled with Scripture undoubtedly add to this deep abiding distrust. After all, it was attempts to understand the Scriptures from a particular point of view that led, well, perhaps a particularly Greek point of view, that led to some of the doctrines that we disagree with the strongest and that we sometimes use to distance ourselves from other faiths. While most Mormons' knowledge of these doctrines and theologies is flawed and quite often unfair, we do have the feeling that making them as a de facto part of Christianity is wrong. Are we incorrect to worry that this might happen to us? Contrast our own faith with the faith found in the history of mainstream Christianity. Mormonism is a religion constantly in flux. It doesn't take much reading of the Journal Discourse to see that how we approach our faith has changed somewhat. But the sheer variety of approaches, worldviews, and rhetoric sometimes just completely astounds me. Recent work examining Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, and others in light of 19th century Hermetic philosophy, ritual, and mysticism has opened the door even wider to this range of ideas that we can find in our own religion. Texts that were once read as if they were the product of a thoroughgoing materialism only a scientist could love are now being reread in the light of things like Neoplatonism. While these approaches usually overstate their explanatory somewhat, it's safe to say that the range of possibilities for Mormon theology is increasing as we gain more light about our history rather than decreasing. If anything, we're coming to realize we know less, not more. With in recent years with writers like Joseph Lean Smith and Bruce R. McConkie, we have a different approach that's been taken to our theology. Yet what they are writing is theology as much as what went on before them. They took a much more dogmatic, much more almost lawyerly approach to the gospel. And I don't think that's necessarily wrong. It's a different point of view that they brought to the gospel and that they brought to our theology. Now, we may disagree with some of the things they wrote, but still, they are doing theology, and it's important to realize the changes they brought to the church. Before they wrote, we had people like Talmage, Woodstow, and B.H. Roberts, who understood the gospel from a standpoint of reason more compatible with the new discoveries of science and scholarship of the time. They lived in a period of change and flux when we moved from the theologies of Brigham Young towards what we now have, with more the theology of Bruce R. McConkie. Those men changed and recreated the popular approaches to theologies and scriptures that were found in the church. Before them, we had the conflicting views of Orson Pratt and Brigham Young. If there's one thing that's consistent about Mormon theology, it's its lack of consistency. If theology has always been present in Mormonism, where might it find its fullest expression? Let me suggest that it's in the arena of apologetics that Mormon theology has its best chance for growth and expression. Consider the rise of formal theology in mainstream Christianity. The early thinkers in Christianity were often defending Christian doctrine against the reasons of the pagans. Even if they could not prove the doctrines, they could at least establish that one could be a Christian and not reject reason. Theology was the attempt to show that Christianity was reasonable. Compare these early Christian defenses to the works of Farms and other apologetics. Consider the historicity of the Book of Mormon. Now, whatever your personal opinions on that, I think you would recognize that apologetics has attempted to show that one can believe the Book of Mormon and not be considered unreasonable, that one could be a thinker and still believe. They establish plausibility and not necessarily what happened. In the same way, we could wish that Mormon thinkers would defend Mormon doctrine and thought against the onslaught of competing ideas. While apologetics frequently do this against the typical attacks of anti-Mormons, it's only been recently that apologists have begun to become a little more sophisticated in their approach to theology. As they become more sophisticated, we can expect defenses of Mormon doctrine to appear on the pages of more rigorous and prestigious journals. What we need are defenses not only aimed at the typical attacker of Mormon converts, but also more intellectual attackers of Mormon thought. The sleight of hand and straw men that all too often accompany apologetics should be eliminated. If we believe that Mormonism is true, we really ought to believe that it can stand up to scrutiny. And that applies to our theology as much as anything else. I think we have an incredibly rich theology that is at least as defensible as mainstream Christianity, and I believe better. I don't want to outline a history of Mormon theology. I'll leave that for others. But I just want to briefly identify a few points that I think any theology needs to take into consideration. I think we should have a deep, abiding distrust of any claim to a particular theology, or that any theology has a claim to truth. By this, I don't mean that there are not absolute truths in Mormonism. Rather, I mean that theologies are the product of human reason. They involve assumptions. They involve presuppositions. They involve a particular worldview. They could be wrong. Any theology is a particular interpretation of a religious traditions and texts. Yet that interpretation depends upon a context to understand it. However, as Paul stated, at this time we see through a glass darkly. We do not know how much further light and knowledge might reformulate our ideas. Beyond our own ignorance, we have a realization that for any given facts, there are frequently many different and unique stories that can be told about those facts. I don't want to fall into the postmodern trap here. Let me just say that it's not a coincidence. There are so many competing ideas and views of the atonement of Christ, of God's nature, and basic cosmology. There's so many competing ideas because so many competing ideas can be given from the text. We should be dubious of any use of theology to change behavior. If we can't trust our theology, then certainly it seems safe to be doubtful of its applicability. There's a very reasonable fear by some that we'll take our theologies and then attempt to remake the church, remake our revelations based upon these new theologies. Some might say this would never happen, but the fact is religious change frequently happens in just this way. Would the Protestants have broken away from Rome had they not felt that their theology was the proper way to conduct their religious business? We should be rigorous in our theology. Well, I believe we all do theology in the church, whether we want to admit it or not. I think it's safe to say we don't all do theology well. If theology is the attempt to systematically and consistently deal with the assumptions of our faith, then we'd best make sure we can support what we say. All too often, dogma replaces reason and wishful thinking logic. For this reason, we ought to support people who will carefully pursue theology full-time, much as we support scientists, mathematicians, and other thinkers. If places like BYU will pay people to study physics, math, and the like, then it's fair to hope that they pay people to study our theology. Finally, I think we should be open to the realm of possibilities allowed by our beliefs, rather than trying to arrive at a theology. As I've mentioned, our beliefs allow for a variety of different approaches and interpretations. Rather than picking just one of these, we should try to find the limits of what's acceptable. The goal should not be to create some grand sweeping narrative that will explain Mormonism. Instead, our theology should explain what we don't know. If our history involves a wide variety of theological views, let's embrace those as well as our own personal views. We have revelations in the church that we all accept as true. Each of us looks at those revelations differently. What I think the grand task of upcoming theology is to say, this is what we believe, and mean by that an explanation of what all Mormons believe, what the range of possibilities of what is allowed is, and not arrive at necessarily what one person thinks everyone ought to believe.
Well, first we have to take care of this identification of me in the program, which Dennis was rude enough to repeat. Vernacular Mormon theologian extraordinaire. Believe me, that was not my idea. I was in England where I couldn't defend myself. I think late one night, David and Elbert were high on coke and came up with that. I've withdrawn my subscription and my many $1,000 contribution to the endowment over it. Mormon I am, a theologian of sorts, certainly extraordinaire, but vernacular, that I ain't. The only vernacular terms I use are crick, wash rag, and bushwah, which are all indigenous to southern Idaho, I admit, but Bert Wilson assures me that is not an official vernacular subregion. I am writer in residence at Utah Valley State College, a devoted and learning husband to Charlotte, a recovering father to six fine children, and a loving grandfather to 13 grandchildren. As for the future of Mormon theology, we're still not certain it has a past or a present, so the future is certainly problematic. And as for me prophesying it, the only prophecy I ever made about the future of Mormonism was 30 years ago, when sitting in a dialogue office trying to understand, with our other editors, the wholly unexpected attacks on our new journal as anti-Mormon, I predicted that by the year 2000, Mormonism would be more mature and moderate intellectually and culturally. It seems I couldn't have been more wrong. So let me try again. Last year in a panel much like this, introducing a series of theological papers on the theme of the scriptural foundations of Mormon theology, we looked at the current state of Mormon theology, the present. I described a particular event, a remarkable event in Mormon intellectual history, when in 1906, B.H. Roberts, in Essays in the Improvement Era, proposed a new liberal theory of how the Book of Mormon was translated, that is, in a process involving Joseph Smith's own mind. At the end of the third article, Elder Roberts, after defending himself against attacks that have been made in response to the first two articles, makes a remarkable statement, one used by Scott Kenney as the text for his opening editorial when Sunstone was founded 25 years ago, and well worth repeating again and again. Mormon theologians ought to read it weekly. Quote, "I believe Mormonism affords opportunity for thoughtful disciples who will not be content with merely repeating some of its truths, but will develop its truths and enlarge it by that development. Not half, not 100th part, not 1,000th part of that which Joseph Smith revealed to the church has yet been unfolded, either to the church or to the world. The work of the expounder has scarcely begun. The prophet planted by teaching the great germ truths, the germ truths of the great dispensation of the fullness of times, the watering and the weeding is going on, and God is giving the increase, and will give it more abundantly in the future as more intelligent discipleship shall obtain. The disciples of Mormonism, growing discontented with the necessarily primitive methods which have hitherto prevailed in sustaining the doctrine, will yet take profounder and broader views of the great doctrines committed to the church, and departing from mere repetition, will cast them in new formulas, cooperating in the works of the Spirit, until they help to give to the truths received a more forceful expression and carry it beyond the earlier and cruder stages of its development." End quote. I take it that by disciples of Mormonism, Elder Roberts meant all of us, and that we are being encouraged to think and speak and write thoughtfully and creatively about the great germ truths given by the prophet Joseph and his successors. That seems to me a good working definition of Mormon theology. And though last year I used Roberts' remarkable challenge to all disciples of Mormonism as a measure of past and present performance, it is also the best description, I believe, of what ought to obtain in the future. We still have not met the challenge. Very little in recent years of what could be called Mormon theology by its tradition. The 70s course in theology and Joseph Smith, the prophet teacher, are, as far as I can tell, no longer studied or even known about by most young Mormons. His major work, The Way, the Truth, and the Life, unpublished in his lifetime when it would have been most relevant intellectually and most helpful in encouraging the courageous, moderate, believing theology he hoped for, was finally published in 1996, but in a way that must gravely disappoint, even insult him looking down from heaven. It was published in two editions by rival camps of Mormon intellectuals, and thus in a way seems to me a complete denial of all he stood for. What hopes for the future then? Well, if you seek B.H. Roberts' monument, look around you. In this panel and in the audience are my hopes for the future. Young Mormon intellectuals engaged in serious, faithful study of philosophy, theology, Mormon scriptures and culture and church life, and talking and writing constantly about the relationships between them. Most are participants in the online discussion group, LDS Phil, where there is constant, lively, exhausting, sometimes careless, rushed, thoughtless, but occasionally brilliant and usually interesting interchange of real theology. I tend to lurk and silently correct the bad English and wince at the hasty thinking, occasionally weighing in with a piece of vernacular theology, often more personal essay than theology, but mainly delighting in learning new words and concepts and chewing on new ideas. It seems those on the list are mainly young, moderate to liberal, non-establishment thinkers. I hope it can gradually be broadened to include some who are older, some who are more conservative, even some who are in the church education system. That's the good news. The bad news is our semi-official establishment theology, if those are good terms for that done by employees of the church education system, seems to be moving away from both the substance and the spirit of what Elder Roberts did and what he stood for. It is becoming more culturally conservative, more traditionally absolutistic, that is, claiming biblical inerrancy, scriptural sufficiency, an omnipotent, non-progressing God, and the substitutionary atonement to be official Mormon doctrine. And it is intolerantly dogmatic, especially of liberal, intolerant especially of, quote, liberal Mormons. In a word, it is becoming more evangelical. The chief exhibit for all this is, of course, the 1997 publication of How Wide the Divide, a Mormon and an evangelical in conversation, by BYU religion professor Stephen Robinson and evangelical theologian Philip Blomberg. The good news is that the book is an excellent model for theological dialogue, both between Mormons and other faiths and among Mormons themselves. The bad news is that the unspoken premise of the book seems to be that people have to believe more alike in order to be more tolerant of each other and civil in their actions and discourse. That, of course, denies the very basis of responsible interfaith dialogue, which posits that people can retain their basic beliefs intact and still converse civilly and learn from each other. I'm sorry, but even if Blomberg and Robinson are totally wrong, and we really do have very different beliefs, we shouldn't be treating each other the way we do. As evangelicals and Mormons, as absolutists and finitists, as conservatives and liberals. The worst news to me is that, indeed, Robinson ends up, I believe, sounding more evangelical than Mormon on crucial issues, most importantly, the nature of God. Robinson effectively faults evangelicals for claiming biblical sufficiency as well as inerrancy, but at the same time basing much of their thought and language on the post-biblical councils, so that they are, quote, wedded to Greek philosophical categories and assumptions, end quote. At the same time, he seems to accept quite uncritically the unbiblical concept of God that arose in those councils, that is, as omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent, an absolute being entirely different in nature from humans. As Robinson puts it, directly addressing perhaps our major difference from other Christians, quote, many evangelicals are convinced wrongly that Latter-day Saints believe in a finite, limited, or changeable God, even though that notion is repugnant to us, end quote. Come to the session on Saturday afternoon that is part of the series that follows this panel on Mormon Theology and Modern Revelation to see how Dennis Potter and I and some other Mormons, like Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, might disagree with that dogmatic statement. The statement goes badly awry in part because Robinson, perhaps necessarily given the purpose of his book and his effort to accommodate evangelical sensitivity to non-biblical sources, like Modern Revelation, discounts what he and Blomberg call non-canonical sources, such as the King Follett Discourse and the writings of Brother Brigham, B.H. Roberts, John Witsow, etc., that we will emphasize in our series of theological papers the rest of this week. Certainly, literal interpretations of the canon support the evangelical doctrines Robinson tends also to accept, such as an all-powerful, absolute, and static God and the substitutionary atonement. But that shows precisely how dangerously limiting scriptural literalism is and how much we need continuous modern revelation and good theology to free us from it. There is another danger in the ascendancy of neo-Orthodox theology, and that is its negative, judgmental quality, wholly at odds, I believe, with the optimistic, liberating quality of Mormon Orthodoxy. I found myself, despite the intelligence and graciousness of Blomberg, increasingly depressed by the dreary, even mean-spirited implications of his theology. Quote, though it is not fair to imagine the Adolf Hitlers of this world experiencing the same punishment as the friendly, hard-working, non-Christian homeowner down the street, they will spend an unpleasant eternity apart from God and all his people, end quote. And I found myself, despite my personal knowledge that Robinson is an affable, generous Latter-day Saint, I found myself offended at his similar acceptance of a scriptural literalism that makes God into an unredemptive punisher. Quote, after the resurrection, those who are filthy still are cast eternally into a lake of fire, end quote. Both evangelicals and Mormons with the absolutistic temperament seem unwilling to tolerate and learn from those with the finitistic. And partly through that influence, American culture
And now our Mormon culture seems to be increasingly intolerant of other people, both politically and theologically. There seems to be a tendency for those who believe in an absolute, sovereign, all-determining and punishing God to have absolute assurance that he has given them, perhaps through an inerrant Bible, absolute truth, which they are justified in using any means, including the law and even illegal force, to impose on others. There is a spirit of no compromise underneath even Blomberg's urbane, well-informed politeness. He and other evangelicals, quote, hope and pray that influential modern LDS authors like Professor Robinson are indeed shifting the balance of Mormon thought back toward grace, end quote. And they are already starting in print to call such people evangelical Mormons, apparently the only Mormons acceptable as Christians. Robinson and others may indeed be shifting the balance of popular Mormon theology because many of them are influential church education system teachers and popular speakers. This is not necessarily bad news. Perhaps it is just an historical shift in temperament or response to our terrible anxiety-producing century, or even a useful correction to an overemphasis on salvation by works or God's finitude. But if, as our experience with evangelical Christians suggests, evangelical Mormons, rather than following the example of this book, are more inclined to be intolerant of those who differ with them, to ostracize or belittle, or especially to use their power over the official and semi-official press and their authority as official church education employees to seek to silence others, that would be very bad news indeed. A related concern is that Blomberg and Robinson end their book with a call for greater, quote, cooperation between evangelicals and Mormons in social and political action. That seemed to me to translate into active social conservatism, which in recent times has meant, in my judgment, mainly negative and divisive practices, pro-family through narrowing our definition of family, anti-pornography through censorship, anti-abortion through restricting choice, anti-gay rights, anti-affirmative action, anti-gun control. It's certainly fine for Mormons to choose to engage in such activities, but it is a tragedy that increasingly those are made to appear as the official and only appropriate forms of political action for Mormons, and they seem to me the forms that tend to reflect the absolutistic temperament which seems on the ascendant. On a more optimistic note, what can I recommend to these younger theologians and to all of us? I suggest that we accept the fact that theology is an honorable activity, not simply something engaged in by a paid clergy or the great and abominable church, one that, in fact, we all engage in constantly, as we've been reminded. It is simply the study of God, or to expand a bit, it is the explication and defense and the application to our lives in a particular society or culture of the revelations of God. We do it whenever we teach or preach or discuss religion, formally or informally, even when we think about our beliefs in relation to our daily living. I recommend that we do it well and courageously, as Elder Robert suggests, taking seriously his call to be genuine disciples of Mormonism, taking profounder and broader views of the great doctrines committed to the Church, and departing from mere repetition, give to the truths received a more forceful expression. Specifically, I call us to take on, with the confidence of believing defenders and loving critics, the cultural matters that we as Mormons are still pretty much in denial about. You'll see here that, different from Clark, I see the main role of Mormon theology not as apologetic, but as cultural criticism. One, the false theology of race that was developed earlier in this century by Mormons as a desperate rationale for the denial of priesthood to blacks is still alive and well in Mormon culture. Some Mormons in Utah still believe and teach others that blacks were unfaithful in the pre-existence and come color-coded into this world, that God marked the descendants of Cain and then Ham with blackness so that he could preserve descendants of Satan on the earth for purposes of opposition, and that all other races are corruptions of the original white race. This is a scandal that prevents full religious maturity, both of individuals and of the church. It needs to be addressed vigorously and lovingly by theologians, by you. Two, the very dangerous idea that polygamy is the superior divine order of marriage, destined to be practiced by all of us in the highest degree of celestial kingdom, is alive and well. Just a few weeks ago, a letter in the Salt Lake Tribune from a Mormon expressed unhappiness with the recent illegal and unsavory activities of Utah polygamists and with polygamy itself, but also admitted that, quote, it is God's divine plan for marriage and we'll all eventually have to live it. Such thinking, I believe, tends to reduce men's fidelity to their present spouses. We'll eventually have others if this one doesn't work out. And increase the likelihood of young Mormons being seduced, literally, into polygamous marriage. After all, that is the divine order. Such thinking needs to be vigorously analyzed by theologians, and the good, rational reasons for married fidelity, one-to-one, explored in strong theological work that can counter both polygamy and its temptations and the current American cultural surrender to premarital and extramarital success as glamorous and inevitable rather than as completely destructive and avoidable. It is a wonder our young people are as chaste as they are, but they need help with careful, thoughtful theology as well as commandments. Despite my criticism of how wide the divide, I admire greatly the effort Steve Robinson has made in interfaith dialogue and hold it out as a model. We should be going to theological schools, writing for the mainstream theological journals, producing articles and books in dialogue with theologians and lay thinkers of other traditions, both to make available our own insights and to learn from others new insights and clearer understanding of our own. The introduction to the Book of Mormon asserts that Christ is revealing himself to all nations, which I believe means to all people, churches, theological schools, etc., which seek him truly. And the passage in 2 Nephi 29 that asserts that God speaks unto all nations of the earth, and they write it, and calls us to bring together the words of the Jews and the Nephites and the lost tribes of Israel, and indeed all who have received God's words, means to me that we must engage in serious effort both to share the words he has given us and our theological understanding of them, and to seek out and receive from others what they have received. There's been some interesting discussion of this on LDS Phil recently about what it can mean to be engaged in ecumenical discussion. I take a rather radical position perhaps on this, but feel it strongly. I think it is utterly unethical, intellectually and morally, for us, either as missionaries or as theologians, to attempt to proselyte others, which I agree we are doing whenever we talk about our faith, and to not be willing to be proselyted. To say to other people, you've got to be willing to accept the possibility, at least temporarily, that you could be completely wrong and consider another option if we're unwilling to do the same. I think we've got to do it. As Warner Woodworth reminded us last night, this is number 4, and Spencer W. Kimball and Hugh Nibley have warned us often in the past, we face the constant danger of materialism. David Hare, the great contemporary British playwright, recently received awards for Amy's View in New York, which many of you may have seen. In a remarkable memorial lecture in Westminster Cathedral in 1996, exclaimed, I do not see how anyone claiming to look objectively at the bulk of the Christian teachings can deny that this is an anti-materialist religion. If Christ may be said to speak from anywhere at all, it is from a platform of redistributive justice. End quote. One of the most challenging and exciting new developments in theology is black theology, led by such thinkers as Dwight Hopkins. It asserts with convincing evidence that Christ came first and mainly to, as he said in his first announcement, preach deliverance to the poor. And this has to do with theology. Charlotte and I have been talking after Warner Woodworth's wonderful presentation last night. What do you do about the terrible conditions of the world? The people, the fact that 35,000 children are dying daily of preventable diseases and conditions that we can do something about. And her response, given her nature, is to send some money, do something, go there, help, and I agree with that. But theology has something to do with this. A recent study in Utah Valley showed that most Mormons believe that there is a direct correlation between being rich and being righteous. Now, you can't tell me that doesn't affect our political decisions, who we elect that makes the decisions that lead to hundreds of thousands of people being hungry, rather than the few we might help with a few dollars. So theology is important. A lot of Mormons I know, maybe majority, believe that those problems out there are simply God's way of disciplining us and helping us improve in this life. That's one way of looking at the problem of evil, which we'll talk about on Saturday. Lots of others believe it's simply part of the preparation for the second coming. Let the world go to hell so Christ can come. Theology makes a difference in how we respond to the realities of the world we're living in. The growing size and power of the church raise serious questions about relations between church and state that need addressing. From the direct involvement of the church in social issues like gay rights to the overwhelmingly conservative Republican cast of Mormons in politics to the exclusion of other perspectives. Perhaps most in need of attention is the inclination for social conservatives with an evangelical cast, which means an increasing number of American Mormons, to want to use majority power to curtail individual rights and impose their own moral agenda on others. Directly contrary, ironically, to everything the American Constitution stands for. In April General Conference, 1998, Elder Richard G. Scott, this is kind of in defense, general defense of a cultural criticism approach rather than an apologetic report or approach in theology. In April General Conference, 1998, Elder Richard G. Scott gave a sobering reminder that our growing world church will contain many cultures, and that not all cultural values and traditions are consistent with the gospel of Jesus Christ. My heart was touched by the Spirit as Elder Scott asked for patience and understanding for his delicate subject. He spoke to us each, as he said, as if one-to-one in a quiet room. I gradually realized he wasn't just speaking to those, as I'm afraid most Mormons assumed, who may have to give up drums and dancing in sacrament meeting or traditions of male-dominant marriages or culturally inscribed class distinctions and hierarchies. He was speaking to every culture, including our own white, Anglo-Saxon, Mormon, Utah, conservative one, and to each one of us with our own set of conservative or liberal cultural traditions or merely vocational or academic perspectives. He said, "This is not easily done. Quote, I have found how difficult it is as I work to overcome some of my own incorrect traditions." Certainly, if Elder Scott needs to critically examine his own incorrect cultural traditions, all of us do. And good theology can help us immensely, I believe. Such faithful cultural criticism is what I hope for the future of Mormon theology.
We have 25 minutes left in this session, a good time for discussion. The hope was that we would stimulate some discussion, so any questions that you have, please ask them. I want to remind you, I'll try to follow who's first and go in the right order, and I'll have you come up. But come up to ask your question up here. State your name and then give your question. Yeah, go ahead.
I really can't just shout it out from the back. My name is John Jenkins. I'm from San Jose, California. And one of the things that I was kind of concerned about in listening to everyone talk is this plea for a tolerant, multiple approach to theology, in that how do we in the trenches perhaps encourage this sort of approach on the local level? I am certainly not one qualified to participate on LDSville. I've looked at it briefly, and it's totally out of my league. But what I have to deal with is a ward in San Jose, California, most of whose members really don't care about any kind of sophistication in their theology. They just want to listen to General Conference, hopefully read the end sign, but they don't want to have to deal with any kind of a complicated approach to the gospel. So how do we, on that level, try to encourage the tolerance and the pluralism that I think most of us would like to hear?
I guess I'll take this one, and if anyone else wants to say something. That's really hard. When I was writing my part of the presentation, I was really thinking about the academic community, and I wasn't even thinking about the Mormon community, generally speaking. I wasn't thinking about the average member of the church. And so that's a very good question, because that is something that needs to be addressed. Obviously, I think that the first thing, though, that needs to be done is that there does need to be this kind of tradition of Mormon theology the way there is in Catholicism. There is a tradition of Catholic theology, and you can disagree with it in Catholicism and still be an Orthodox Catholic. And that's not an oxymoron. It sounds like an oxymoron, but you can still be a believing Catholic and just disagree with some aspects of the tradition. But it is important that tradition is there, this whole tradition of thinking, this way of drawing distinctions. It gets people thinking in a sophisticated way. It gets people... sometimes you have to draw the distinction just to realize that it's an invalid one. You have to see what the distinction is first before you can understand that it needs to be, that there's something wrong with it. And I think that if that kind of academic tradition is developed, I think that will help people at the ground level to some extent. But right, I mean, this is thinking very much in the future and thinking very optimistically. I'm still young. I think optimistically, idealistic. But the other thing that this is what I do. I go to my ward, and as soon as I go to a new ward, I've been going to new wards a lot because I'm a student. I've moved from school to school. And I go to my ward, and as soon as I get there, I go in and talk to the bishop, and I say, look, I'm going to bring stuff up anytime I get a chance where I disagree with what people are saying, and I'm going to state why. And I want you to know, when I do this, I do not have the intention of undermining the faith of anyone in the ward. And I'm very explicit about this. I want the people in the ward to know that that when I'm trying to get people to think about issues, that I don't want to undermine their faith. And I think by doing this, for some reason, I've been lucky, or maybe it is this strategy that I've employed. They're totally tolerant in my ward of me bringing up controversial issues, disagreeing just outright with what the gospel doctrine teacher says. They called me to teach Elders Quorum. When I'm teaching Elders Quorum, I bring up the context in which Brigham Young's quotes come from. I talk about these contexts. I show how sometimes the quotes are misleading about what Brigham Young really thought. And nothing. No, people are very interested in this. They think about it. Sometimes they even come up with the answers that I would have given to questions that I raise in class. They come up with the answers that I would have given and thought would have been radical. They come up with the answers themselves in class. And so, at least in my ward, people are doing that kind of thinking to some extent, or at least they're open to doing it. They're not as close to doing it as I would have expected. Now, if I were to do this at BYU, maybe that would be a different thing, or in an institute class. I don't know. Go ahead.
The other thing that Mormon theologians ought to read weekly, besides B.H. Roberts, is the 121st section of the Doctrine and Covenants. Charlotte and I have been in the trenches that were spoken of for over 50 years now. We've been in wards where, at least initially, we were seen as worse than anti-Mormons. And yet we've enjoyed, and still enjoy, even in our present ward, a remarkable degree of acceptance and trust. And I think it has to do with not only intending not to destroy faith or to hurt other people, but being perceived as not intending. I think Mormons get a kind of a bad rap of being intolerant and so conservative they won't listen to other points of view. I think if they trust you, they will. And I think gaining that trust is the real challenge of intellectuals in the church who want to make a serious contribution. Being humble enough to be willing to learn, but also humble enough to present oneself in a way that gains trust. How do you do that? It's not easy. It requires skills. It requires constant effort. It requires not only courage, but a certain kind of humility. And the 121st section outlines the qualities that are required. One of them being patience, and it ends up with a wonderful phrase that deeply moves me, and I've seen it happen when I was a branch president in Minnesota among people that would never have wanted to talk to me about my social activism at Stanford and my other concerns, but learned to because they came to trust me as their pastor. What happened is they came to believe through the way I treated them and talked to them, and with them, and learned from them, and loved them, and acted as a good pastor, that my faithfulness was stronger than the cords of death. I think it's the challenge of every member of the church who wants to be involved in helping other people see new things as well as learning from them, to convey that kind of feeling and gain that kind of trust. And then the promise that follows comes, that there will be power descending like the dews of heaven, and you will be trusted. It's not easy. It's a constant effort, but it can work.
Real quick, I just wanted to say something more about the trust, and then we'll go to this question here. I firmly believe that the rift, there's somewhat of a rift between some more liberal Mormon intellectuals and some more conservative Mormon intellectuals, and there's also a rift sort of between intellectuals and the rest of the church that has been created recently. And I think that it's not just the church, and it's important that this audience hears this, it's not just the church and the conservatives who are at fault here. It's to some extent the liberals or the people who are challenging the authority of the establishment, because they're not always entirely honest. We have not always been entirely honest. We have not always been as well intentioned as we could be. And I think that we need to show others that we do care about the religious beliefs, that we do believe them, that Mormonism is important to us, and that our goal is not to undermine it. And I think that to some extent we bear the burden of the guilt of having that rift, and I think that we need to do something about that.
Question for the panel. It seems to me that one of the problems with theology and theologians is that the emphasis is placed on intellectual honesty and not nearly as much, I think, as it should be on emotional or spiritual honesty. Somehow, if our theology does not include both of those, it seems to me that it has the danger of becoming what theology sometimes becomes, which is rather arid and sterile. So I'd be interested in the comments there. Also, the extent to which we have in the church a fixed theology and the explorations of theology of other theological traditions, including those non-Christian theological traditions, which may in fact include some of the revelations of God spoken of in the Book of Mormon, and the extent to which in the future, in the 21st century, Mormon theology might reach out to examine and explore theologies of a non-Christian nature. So,
nobody wants to respond. Let me just say, Bob, I meant to imply in my quotation of 2 Nephi 29, certainly not limited to Christian. I think if God's spoken to all nations, he's certainly spoken to India and to Russia. And our challenge is to find out how and why and what we can learn from that.
I understood you to do that. My question is, do you think Mormon theology is open to that? Mormon theologians, are we interested in exploring that, or do we basically exclude that because we consider it not relevant?
I was the one guilty of saying apologetics is a great way to do theology. Let me say that as the church becomes a worldwide church, we're going to have to run into that. You know, up to this point in our history, the main people we've been proselyting have been Protestants and Catholics. In the future, that's not going to be true anymore. As we grow in Asia, if we grow in a lot of these other countries, we're going to have to come up with ideas of how do we explain our theology and our views to these very, very radically different world views. I don't think at this point in our history we really have come to grips with that yet, and we still are trying to use this cookie-cutter mold with other faiths and other religions. Inexorably, as the church grows China, Japan, and places like that, we're going to have to come to grips with Buddhism and things like that. And I know when I was at BYU, some of the classes we had some great Buddhist scholars who actually did raise really interesting parallels between the church and some of these more non-Christian faiths. So I think it's going on. I just don't think people are really taking it seriously at this point. I think they will have to in the future, because eventually Europeans and Americans are no longer going to be the main force in the growth of the church. You know, there's lots of interesting things, even if you want to, and go back into the early history of the church, the way Quinn and some other recent scholars have done, where they're bringing in Kabbalism and things like that and saying, hey, these were an impact on the early church. Whether that's true or not, it's up for debate. But as soon as you start getting into that, well, then you get into the question of mysticism. You get into the questions of meditation and things like that. Some people are actually claiming that the way some of the early brethren viewed the endowment was as a mystic ascent that was meant to be viewed more in a Buddhist way than the materialistic way I tend to view it and most other people do. So I think it's going on. I just don't think it's really taken off yet.
I guess in some ways the question was, do we look for parallels? Do we look for enlightenment that might in fact challenge some of our theological axes?
Well, to the degree we start reinterpreting our own way of looking at things, yes. I can say in my own personal life, as I've studied some of the more esoteric forms of masonry, as I've studied some of these other things, it has affected what I like to call the range of possibilities I allow in Mormon theology. You know, I've studied Zen Buddhism, meditated, and things like that, and in that I don't personally distinguish truth from truth. You know, what I learn in my science, what I learn in meditation, what I learn in other things, sure, it's all the same. You know, I admit I don't take it as seriously as I do my Mormonism, but it certainly affects it. And I would hope that would be true of everyone.
At the risk of sounding more conservative than I think I really am, I'd just like to say I think that while, as Brigham Young said in a recent lesson I was reading, we should be little bees roaming all over the earth gathering truth, I also think that the scriptures that we already have acknowledged as the foundation of our community's faith now are so far from tapped for the knowledge that we've been asked to get from them that before we start looking at other scriptures, I think we have a long way to go with our own, and that our emphasis should be very much there. I'll attempt a very a little bit of an answer to the question about emotional honesty, just to the extent of saying I think it's a very difficult issue. I think it's very easy for people to give reasons for their beliefs that are not the real reasons why they believe those things. I think, though, there are serious limits to how far speech, logos, can take us in dealing with emotions, especially when we're doing theology in a written form or in a public forum. And I think questions of emotional honesty usually need to be dealt with in more personal forums, such as with friends and family. But I have a strong hope that as our theology develops and we have a greater plurality of views around, people will recognize how much more we have to learn from our scriptures. I think today there are a few sort of ways of reading the scriptures that have become popular enough that we don't realize how much more there is to the scriptures. And as we start to recognize how many important questions the scriptures have answers to that we haven't dug into, not just on the public level, but on the private level, our discussions of the gospel will be greatly enriched.
Could I just support that idea by suggesting that we be open to other forms of theology than what we thought of as the traditional discursive ones? If I'm a vernacular theologian, it's simply one way of saying I write personal essays. And I think that's an important form of theology. In fact, I think good fiction is. I think I have learned more good theology from the fiction and personal essays of Levi Peterson and the devotional writing of Chieko Okazaki than many formal theologians. So I would say one way of getting at whatever emotional honesty is, and that's a difficult term, is that at least the range of emotional expression seems to me broader in those other forms.
My name is John Nilsson. I'm from Provo. Liturgy can be a very powerful, unifying thing. I guess my question relates to this. Taking the sacrament, participating in the temple ordinances is a very unifying thing. You're participating in the same kind of thing everyone else is, irrespective of your different stands on issues. It's a very powerful thing and draws all kind of people, including myself. We've been talking a lot about exploration, discussion. It seems that liturgy can be a substitute for theology for a lot of people. What is the role of Mormon theology in explicating the liturgy, especially when we are officially prohibited? I cannot even discuss, as an initiate of the temple ceremonies, I cannot discuss that with another initiate even. So what are the possibilities for that in the future of Mormon theology, bringing in insights, presenting papers to people not of our faith in terms of explaining some of the most sacred ceremonies, or is that something that's going to be forever off limits?
So we're going to have to hold a symposium in the celestial room. No. I think we can talk generally speaking about ordinances, and we can develop a good theology of ordinances. We definitely have a different view of ordinances than Protestants have, at least, and probably a different view than the Catholics have, especially with the liberalization of Catholicism. Maybe more traditional and conservative Catholics have a view that's similar to ours. But ordinances are very important, and we have not explained why they're necessary. We've not explained why they're efficacious, I don't think. I don't think there's good explanations for that yet, and I don't think there are good explanations even for why vicarious atonement would ever work. Why does this work? And I think that vicarious ordinances. Did I say atonement? I'm sorry. I meant to say vicarious ordinances. So I think that there's a lot of work to be done in the area of liturgy and dealing with ordinances, generally speaking. And we can say a lot without ever having to talk about the specifics of the temple ceremony that we're not allowed to talk about. And on the issue of trust, I think it is important that we honor the church's position on that. I don't think we should talk about that. I think it's sacred, and I think that that should be kept to the celestial room. And as theologians, yeah, that's off limits. Maybe there are some things that should be off limits. Maybe there are some things that the only place that we should talk about them is the celestial room. There was a second question here, and then back to you.
Could I just say one word about that? I agree wholeheartedly with Dennis, but I think we should talk more in the celestial room than we do. I think we do need to talk about these things, and when we go there, we should take that sacred opportunity to stay there and talk about them with each other, as spouses, as friends, whatever, and do it, because we can do it there. The other thing is, I think we can be a little more experimental in ritual itself. This relates to an earlier question, but a wonderful story I heard, if it's not true, it should be, is that there's a congregation in India of people from these other traditions, now Mormons, who gather together a half hour before the service and repeat the name of the church as a mantra for a half hour. Now, there's a new ritual. It doesn't seem to me it has been or will be forbidden by the church, but it seems to me a very interesting widening out and yet applying to Mormonism. I've been an advocate for some time that Mormons ought to start to have some kind of celebration, even ritual, on Maundy Thursday, the night of the atonement. We believe, have some specific scriptural beliefs about what happened that night that other people don't have. And yet that's one of the earliest Christian celebrations that we have record of, people celebrating that evening with foot washing and other things. I'm not saying we need to do that, but I think Mormons could begin to, we have all these feelings about Good Friday and avoid it and go fishing instead of celebrating it. Maybe Thursday night we could feel a little better about doing something. But there are some things we could do in practice of rituals, and well as general discussion.
The other question?
Yeah, I'll try and make this quick. I have so many questions. I'm a graduate student at Arizona State in philosophy, and it's nice to see this many Mormon philosophers here. But I must confess, I have a lot of misgivings about the kind of plurality of views about how to do Mormon theology. We've heard a special type of hermeneutics, apologetics, and a systematic theology. I know.
Don't forget cultural criticism.
And cultural criticism. My own field, although I'm in an analytic department, is phenomenology, and I'm working on the theory of revelation. And I can't help but thinking I've got the best approach because, I'll just make this quick. Louis Midgley, in his article Encyclopedia of Mormonism, takes on the characterization of theology and the history of the Christian tradition. And basically his conclusion is that there really isn't any real counterpart to theology of Mormonism. The claim is that our theology comes out of the history of God's direct interaction with prophets through a revelatory process that's not really well understood. There's not a really good taxonomy for it, and I'm trying to develop one. But that kind of circumvents the whole need for conceptualization. I think the reason most members are suspicious of theology is because perhaps it's not so wrong or dangerous, but superfluous. If you have an immediate faith in God through direct experience, however that may happen, these elaborate conceptualizations are, you know, wide of the mark. I really don't agree with that completely either, but I'd like someone to comment about that. The second thing is that Brother England, you seem to have thrown down the gauntlet on a lot of political issues that have been a big concern to me, specifically in reading one of Elder Oaks' BYU devotionals about my own position on abortion, but other positions as well. It seems like I can see a kind of crisis happening as you said, a lot of conservative positions in the church become normative, not just in virtue of the culture, but also in virtue of expressions by many general authorities, and it concerns me a great deal. I'm not quite sure the best reaction I can have with my Orthodox friends or even explain my position to my academic colleagues that are irreligious, and I use that